This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at pilots who are flying supplies into areas hit by hurricanes. In the news, we consider the need for more mandatory pilot training, United Technologies buying Rockwell Collins, and geared turbofan engines. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 469 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, good evening to all of you all over the world who have nothing better to do with your time, so you're going to listen to us gab. I think that's marvelous.
It does sound good. I hope we bring you value with our gabbing. I think so. And to help bring value, we have the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's also a CFI, an author, and of course, a glass cockpit expert. Max T, how are you?
Hey, Max, and hello, Morab and our guest here. I'm fine, thanks. And I'm just looking at the beginning of a thunderstorm out here. So if I disappear in the middle of the broadcast, you know why.
I hope not. All right. Well, Brian Coleman is still off in South Africa, and David seems to be trapped at work. So it's just the three of us plus our guest, who this episode is Nicholas Rizzo. He's the flight training technology designer at Redbird Flight Simulations. Nicholas is one of those guys been fascinated by planes since he was a kid. He turned first to home flight simulation, flying X-Plane. In fact, he's chief captain at X-Plane Junkies. But last year, Nicholas decided to become a real flying junkie. He's logged 250 hours since last September, obtaining his private pilot license and instrument rating. He's also planning on pursuing his commercial CFI and CFII in the coming months. But lately, Nicholas has been flying supplies into the hardest hit areas from Hurricane Harvey in Texas. And so we have a lot of interesting topics to talk about with Nicholas. So Nicholas, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, it is an honor to be here. One of my favorite aviation podcasts ever. So Max and Rob, pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, it's great to have you. And yeah, it's always nice when we have a guest who's also one of our listeners. And we kind of ran across your activities in Texas there in one of the Slack teams. I'm not sure if it was the Airplane Geek Slack team or the Airline Pilot Guy Slack team. It might have been the latter one.
Yes, it was. As the Airline Pilot Guy happened to post a couple of pictures of my flight down to, I believe that post was about Rockport. And that's how he contacted me through there.
Very cool. So we've got some good stuff to talk about coming up. But why don't we get started first off with the aviation news from the past week, or at least a little bit of it. So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Yeah. Ready from the West.
Ready from Central Texas.
Our first story comes from AIN, their blog. Could mandatory training lower the accident rate? And this is a piece by Matt Thurber. And Matt writes, the FAA's attitude about mandatory training for larger and more complex airplanes is surprisingly lackadaisical. And he talks about, a number of different examples. He talks about how an instrument-rated single-engine private pilot with a high performance and complex endorsement can jump into another type without additional training. Another example, you can get your multi-engine in a fairly simple airplane like the Piper Seminole, but with that you can jump into a Navajo or a Cessna 310 or 421 or King Air, a Twin Command or something of that sort. Max T, can you kind of set this up for us? Is this something that is kind of concerning in terms of the need or the apparent need for more mandatory training from the regulators?
I think he brought up some interesting points. I had run across this a few days ago when it came up. And you know, the first comment would be, yes, it's true. You could go ahead and jump immediately into these higher-end aircraft without any additional requirements from the FAA. He says no additional training is required. Well, point of fact, no insurance company is going to let somebody jump into a PC-12 without a significant amount of training. So I think his point here is the FAA doesn't require additional training, but I don't think it's really needed because the insurance companies have taken care of that particular requirement. Now, this interesting point about the Cirrus is that it's so simple to fly that it doesn't require a type rating. And I suspect he's correct on that point. But I also suspect the FAA doesn't want to start making exceptions and be in the business of deciding which airplanes are simple enough they don't need a type rating and which jets are so complicated they do need a type rating there. That would be tough for them to arbitrate.
But, you know, I took it slightly differently, Max, when I read Matt's piece and I said the same thing to Matt. I'm sorry. Boy, Max, and Matt. This is a problem.
It's a little difficult.
Anyway, I guess I have always thought that I wished we had better training for GA pilots, not in the sense of making certain that everyone was completely checked differently before they flew, a Cirrus the first time, but in the sense of recurrent training. And I think that was, to me at least, what the point was that Matt was saying is that, you know, we don't really do much in terms of requirements for people, even though we have a flight review due every 2 years. That is so minimal. And as we all know, that people that don't fly very often probably need more recurrent training, not less. I understand the insurance company issue, I also don't think that any of the manufacturers would probably be interested in seeing something like that happen, probably, or the AOPA and EAA guys wouldn't either, because they're already thinking we're losing pilots as it is, and why would we make it even harder? That doesn't mean I don't think it's right. I would like to see it, but I just don't see how they'd ever get it through.
Yeah, I thought the article was interesting in that at the very end, he kind of tied back into the title with this point that having something more than just a flight review every 2 years would make sense. But most of the examples he gave in the middle here were about people stepping up to higher performance aircraft. Yeah, I think somebody who is flying only, let's pick a low number, 10 hours a year, yeah, they probably do need some more training than just a flight review every 2 years.
I'm curious, are beginning student pilots very discriminatory when it comes to deciding or choosing which aircraft they want to learn in? Nicholas, when you were going through your training, did you care what you flew, or did you go for a certain type, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, I had a pretty interesting experience in my private pilot training. I started at a flight school flying 172s, and all the other options were like a 152 or 172, and I chose the 172s, did about 40-some-odd hours in that. And then I bought into a flying club here that had an Archer and a Warrior, and I decided to finish off my private pilot training in a Warrior. And even though a lot of people think, oh, those are very similar trainers, the feeling of just changing from that low to the high wing to low wing and the differences of the Warrior, it was a big challenge for me to really, the skills that I'd mastered in the 172 to translate to the Warrior. And it took me some time. So I have a whole different respect on if I'm going to go jump in another airplane now to make sure I'm really, confident and been trained well. So.
Did you do that midway through your training or after you got your private?
it was mid, well, it was actually on the tail end. There's a long story way, way bigger than this podcast could handle, but I changed after I'd actually been signed up for my check ride in the 172. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, all I can say is, ouch, that's hardly ideal. You know, I recommend that when folks, you know, once they've got a certain amount of their flight training under their belt, just stay in that type, but it sounds like you weren't able to.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are just issues with an instructor, so make sure you pick a great instructor.
Yeah, well, that's probably the most important thing. But, Maxie, that's interesting what you say. So the best strategy is not go for some variety in order to you kind of broaden your experience base, but you're saying instead stick with one plane.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I ran into, at the extreme, a guy who was still a student pilot. He'd flown, like, I can't remember, 30 different types, and it took him forever to get his license. He was just having fun trying out different aircraft. But I think if you're going to try different airplanes, try it out at the very beginning. And then, you know, if you want to try a couple different types, yeah, do that in your first 10 hours and then stick to one after that. And as for picking a good instructor, I actually just made exactly that comment. Somebody on Facebook today had said, gosh, should I go with a school that's only got round gauge 172s or with a flight school that has glass cockpit Diamond DA-40s? And my comment was, pick the best instructor. The heck with the airplane. I mean, that's really not, that's secondary, I think. You want to develop good habits early in your training. He wanted an airline career, and I think it's important to, you know, get good habits established from the start.
I would agree.
Sounds good.
And actually, a little bit to go back to where this mandatory training helped lower the accident rate. You know, we have companies like Cirrus that are now doing programs to really train pilots transitioning to their aircraft, transitioning from within model to model within their aircraft line, that, you know, the manufacturers are stepping up to make sure that pilots are flying safer. And I don't think we necessarily need the FAA to mandate these types of things. I think our industry does a pretty decent job of trying to encourage that.
Okay. All right. Why don't we push ahead? Next item. This comes from Flying Magazine. And I suspect this has been penned by our Rob Mark. This is United Technologies to buy Rockwell Collins. And United Technologies has confirmed that they will purchase Rockwell Collins for $30 billion. This new company would be called Collins Aerospace Systems. And I guess, Rob, the idea is that a little bit of the senior guys from Rockwell Collins would have leadership positions as well as some of the UTC guys.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, this has been a rumor for the last, a solid rumor for the last month, but there were ideas flying around about this for a long time that Rockwell Collins just couldn't, I don't want to say couldn't survive, but wouldn't survive as an entity on its own, because somebody was going to go in there and scoop them up. And United Technologies did that. And what I think is interesting, beside the fact that the deal was mostly cash and some stock, I mean, which shows that, you know, United Technologies wanted them, and it wasn't just a kind of a fluffy leveraged move. The fact that now United Technologies is going to be competing on a broad scale with some of the people that it already provides parts and accessories to. I mean, that's what I think the Boeing people are concerned about. And of course, they took an interesting stand, saying, you know, okay, we're going to look at this really closely and see what we think about it. And if we don't like it, we're going to raise our hands and tell people, because we think that Rockwell Collins made a deal with us, and they should be focusing on, United Technologies and Rockwell Collins had deals with us, and they ought to be focused on fulfilling their contracts, not worrying about all this other silliness. And so I guess that remains to be seen. But another one bites the dust, I guess, is the best way to say it.
Yes, a little more consolidation in the industry. It takes a long.
How much more can we have?
It seems like not much. It seems like most has taken place, and the players that remain are all pretty big, and I think would be rather difficult to be absorbed by some other company. They're just too big. They're all giant.
Should
now.
We start a rumor that Southwest Airlines is going to buy United?
Yeah.
Except they don't want them. No,
yeah, maybe. Know. Yeah, but these things take a long time. Reported, Rob, that the idea is that this deal wouldn't close until the third quarter of next year, 2018. So, you're basically talking a year to put together the details and actually make it happen. The new company reportedly would be called Collins Aerospace Systems. And right now, of course, UTC, United Technologies, has aerospace systems. And what we see here is that the current Rockwell Collins chairman, Kelly Ortberg, would become the CEO of the new company, and UTC Aerospace Systems president, who's David Gitlin, would become the president and COO. So a little bit of the management team from both UTC and Rockwell Collins.
But I think the other point we want to make is that I'm sorry, I saw something pop up on the screen here about auto loop or something. Was that Max Trescott that was sending us that message?
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's see if there's something I need to do about it.
Max T, you're still there?
No. Yeah, I'm here. I was on mute. I was just wondering, Max Flight, if you, on your laptop, run Audio Hijack or Loopback or something like that.
Because
know that Wilson.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Okay. Still trying to figure out why your voice is so good and ours are not. But, it could be those golden pipes you have, sir.
Well, I don't know.
So what was the point I was going to make?
Yeah, I know. We just sidetracked ourselves.
I know. I was going to say, we speak a great deal about the strategic flight level 390 management teams. But, what I think is really important is let's not forget that the folks down in the trenches doing the work at UTC and Rockwell Collins are probably not quite as excited about this as some other folks are, because – usually this kind of coming together means there are going to be jobs that are going to be lost.
Well, that's an interesting point, Rob. And of course, that comes about by consolidation. You take a look at the two companies pre-acquisition, and you look for overlap and redundancies that can be cut out, and like you say, to reduce costs. But it's other than maybe some administrative kinds of functions, the product lines of the two don't overlap much at all. So from that standpoint, it's not really an action that seeks to generate efficiencies by consolidation. But you never know, and I think you're right, Rob. The guys down in the trenches always in a case like this wonder, what does it mean for me? What does it mean for the company? So I guess we got roughly 12 months to find out.
Yeah, that's always good. That's when they call you into the office and say, "Hey, Max, let's chat for a second. Close the door behind you when you come in."
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Okay. Anyway.
All right. Next item. This is from DPA on the net. New record aerospace gearbox reaches 70,000 horsepower. And this is an article about Rolls-Royce and the fact that they have a test rig of what they call the power gearbox that is going to be used for their next generation ultrafan engine. And that's reached 70,000 horsepower on a test rig. That's not the end of it for Rolls. They have a goal of getting that gearbox capable of 100,000 horsepower for the ultrafan. So this is the geared turbofan that that Rolls-Royce is looking at here, is trying to develop. But I thought it might be interesting just to look at sort of the relative power levels of some of these different engines for some of these different aircraft. And if you start with the C-Series, for example, where the Pratt geared turbofan started, you're looking at pounds of thrust in the 19 to 23,000 range. The MRJ, that's a smaller engine, 15,000 pounds. We also have the Embraer E-Jets, the smaller 175s with a geared turbofan. You're looking at engines in the 15 to 17,000 pound thrust range, whereas a larger 190 and 195 E-Jets, you're talking 17 to 23. So those are all kind of on the small end of the scale. You've got the A320 Neo family with the geared turbofan, and you're, depending on the model, you're looking at a thrust in the range of 24 to 35,000 horsepower. So rather pounds of thrust. So when you look at the 70,000 that Rolls-Royce is achieving, it's kind of a big jump over what's currently out there or coming online soon. So it's a big jump. And just by comparison, you say, okay, so if an A320 is 24 to 35,000 pounds of thrust, what's a, for example, an A350? The Dash 900 model is 84,000 pounds of thrust, and the 777 is up to, again, it depends on the Dash model, but you can be talking about up to 115,000 pounds of thrust. So clearly Rolls-Royce is looking to develop this technology in a way that it can support really the largest aircraft. Now, we did hear from listener Dave, who commented that when we were talking about the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine, was that last episode or the one before? I can never remember. And we talked about, is that the first one? And the answer is really not really. And Dave points out the Garrett TFE 371, which has been around for quite a while. Initially is Garrett, now is Honeywell. Maybe 40 years uses a gear. And there are other turboprops and other engines that also have a gear in the fan. The Lycoming, the ALF 502, and the 507. The Turbo Mecha has an Asta fan, and there's an Aspen. And so you have seen these gears in other engines in the past, but not to the thrust levels that we're seeing, and certainly not to the thrust level that Rolls-Royce is working to achieve. And you know what? I suspect that all of the major engine makers are working on that same problem. So Rob, I think there's probably a gear in your future, no matter what you end up flying.
Well, people have often accused me of having been a few gears short anyway, so maybe this is going to be an overall improvement.
Yeah. And again, as we described in the past, the motivation for gearing the fan so that it runs at a different speed than the turbine in the engine, there are several. One is tip speeds, and we talked about that. And that's particularly true for turboprops because you've got such a large propeller out there, and it's easy for the tip to go supersonic without a reduction gear in place. And we talked about how in a large turbofan, motivation is a bigger fan generating more thrust but turning more slowly, quieter, and with less fuel consumption. Again, I think that this is something that you're going to see from all of the major engine OEMs eventually. All right, pushing ahead, we want to talk about pilots aiding in victim support. And Max T, you identified a number of interesting articles here that are talking about this. And maybe we can use this to kind of lead into our discussion with Nicholas. But Max, what did you find?
Well, I've been really intrigued over the last couple of weeks to see what General Aviation was doing to assist in the relief effort. And I've been posting a number of different articles on my Patreon page for the Aviation News Talk blog. And the best articles I saw came out of AOPA. David Tullis did two really great articles in which she was just summarizing some of the many different organizations that were involved. So I just put together a quick list of them. In both articles, he mentioned Aerobridge. Operation Airdrop was mentioned in one of the articles, and I interviewed their founder yesterday. So that's the latest Aviation News Talk podcast, talks about Operation Airdrop. A smaller group called the Cajun Air Force, which I think was a group of folks who decided to leverage the name the Cajun Navy. And again, some of these organizations are ad hoc. They literally were just kind of created, 2 weeks ago. Angel Flight South Central, now they've been around for a long time. Normally they're providing medical flights for patients that need to get to doctor's appointments and things like that. But in this case, they decided to fly some relief supplies. Air Charity Networks, which is, I think, an umbrella organization. Remote Area Medical, or RAM. They're based out of Tennessee, and they've got a pair of Cessna 208s. And they provide a lot of medical services in the Tennessee and Kentucky area. And then, of course, Civil Air Patrol has been going. Texas Wing of Civil Air Patrol has had a number of aircraft up in the air, providing a lot of different missions. So general aviation is really shining during this whole effort. And it looks to me like some of these organizations, especially Operation Airdrop, are now looking toward Florida and the Caribbean and trying to figure out how to take what they've learned in the Harvey cleanup to help with Irma relief.
Hmm. And, this is always a good source of potential candidates when you're thinking about where you want to distribute your charitable contributions to organizations. Those in this list, for example, that are nonprofits, can be excellent places to support with your dollars. Nicholas, how did you come to be involved in providing some support? And in fact, tell us about that, but also maybe describe a little bit about just exactly what you've been doing.
All right. So when the storm was approaching the Houston area, I'm a member of a Facebook group for Austin pilots where I live, Austin, Texas. And, people are kind of asking around a little bit of, hey, once everything kind of settles down a little bit, what can I do to help? And since I became a private pilot, I'd actually registered with a couple of organizations, knowing that I have to, get a bunch of hours before I can get my commercial rating and so forth. So it's like I want to use those hours and do something good. So I've looked at like Veterans Airlift Command, Pilots and Paws, and I hadn't found great missions for me to fly, but this just happened to come up. And there was a group out of Georgetown Airport, which is just north of Austin, that happened to be collecting a bunch of supplies in one of the hangars up there. And so people were asking, hey, if you guys can get airplanes to Georgetown, we'll send you to places that need them. And so I said, hey, I'll be there. And my first mission was to fly down towards Rockport. So that's kind of how I got into this particular thing here. And it was rather disorganized those first day. And then by the end of the process, it was kind of a well-oiled machine, which was pretty impressive.
Was that the Skyhope Network?
I felt like there were a few organizations in there. Operation Airdrop sounds familiar. There's also a Patients Airlift Command or Patients Airlift PALS based out of like New York had some people there too that were helping coordinate. But for me, I was just answering Facebook messages and, I got a couple of text messages from people as well too saying, hey, can you fly this to West Houston Airport or can you fly this to Orange? So I wasn't working directly through those organizations per se.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Facebook, because I think that's probably a common theme. Doug Jackson, when he worked with a couple of other people to put together Operation Airdrop, said that the very first thing they did was put together a page on Facebook. And that really became the major way to organize things. They would post the missions, and they would use it as a way to recruit pilots and place for people to submit information about how many pounds they could carry and all that kind of stuff. So I was really impressed at how Facebook really became a way for someone to put in a fairly small effort to create an IT repository for running an ad hoc operation.
Hmm. So how does this all come about? In other words, is it one organization, say, is able to collect the supplies that are needed and doesn't have the capability to deliver it themselves. And so they say, well, okay, we need some others to deliver it. Or is it a more consolidated organization? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Is it all sort of separate little groups doing little pieces, and somehow they get coordinated to provide the service? Or is it all integrated?
Well, in my particular experience, it was definitely a bunch of organizations kind of coming together and figuring it all out as they went. You know, I guess in this area, a response hasn't been needed like this before. So in unfortunate case, something like this is needed again, hopefully it'll be one step closer to a more organized response. But, you know, it's a bunch of little tiny groups that happen to know contacts in all the various areas. And they did a really good job of letting the pilots know, this is the airport that needs supplies or can handle supplies. These are the types of supplies they need. And they were great at figuring out what aircraft would be best to go where, you know, based on how much they can carry and things like that.
So what kind of supplies were you bringing in?
Oh, you know, the first flight was kind of a random collection of food and what they were calling care packages. And I think a local church had gotten a whole bunch of backpacks, and in some backpacks they put things that were really meant for babies or small children, and then other bags were labeled as male or female for various items that males and females would need. So that was kind of my first run, and then after that it was kind of more the same: lots of food, lots of water packages, and cleanup items started becoming more requested towards the end as well.
And how about at the airports? I'm thinking in terms of fuel and things. Was that an issue?
It was an issue. As a matter of fact, pretty much every pilot before they left was, who do I need to contact there to see what their fuel situation are? Or in some cases, if you're flying kind of later in the day, do they have electricity? Are the runway lights going to be on if they get delayed or and things like that? So yes, fuel, electricity, things like that were always a concern. And, you know, like in Rockport, I was able to actually get some fuel, but I literally got the last 20 gallons of fuel they had to offer. In West Houston Airport, you know, they were willing to pretty much just kind of give fuel to people there, or highly discounted just as a thanks. But they seem to be doing pretty well on inventory.
And tell us, what was it like flying into these areas? As you're looking down below, what did you observe, and how did that make you feel?
Well, the first flight into Rockport was the one where it really set in for me. You know, going from Austin there, I was actually with another pilot friend of mine, and everything looked normal. You know, we're flying over there, looking down, everything looks great. And then probably about the 10 or 15 minutes before we got to the Rockport area, started realizing that, wait, those lakes aren't supposed to be down there below us. And so we started seeing, man, there's a lot of standing water. And then Rockport's a kind of like a little island right off the coast. And we had to fly out towards the Gulf to loop back around. And we could just see that all the piers were just destroyed. There were spots on the ground where you could tell there was a building. And now it's just either just gone or maybe a little bit of rubble around it. You could just see the devastation, and it started becoming really apparent. And shortly after we landed, I remember where I was trying to find my taxiway off. There was a plane, maybe like a 172, that was just completely mangled and like upside down in the grass area, maybe 25 feet off the runway area. And we could see the hangars that literally were just collapsed and destroyed. And that's when everything really set in. And once we parked the airplane and the airport manager came out, there was a local church collecting the supplies from the planes. You could see in their face how devastated they were, but at the same time, you could see how thankful they were that people were bringing them the things they needed. And, you know, it took a moment. I kind of had to sit for a moment and process things. I had to take a little walk away from everybody just to kind of get myself together. And that's actually when I decided that, you know, I need to fly more of these than just this one flight.
Yeah, that's great. This has been characterized, and not just this, but I think the the hurricane in Florida, which, as we're recording this, is a bit fresher, and the devastation really isn't fully understood at this point. So I'm sure it'll be the same. But one of the things you get from the press reports anyway is the degree to which people have pulled together. These are people that, you know, under different circumstances may have, you know, had some difficulty relating to each other or agreeing on almost anything. But when you're in a situation like this, people pull together. And it's just wonderful to see that pilots are contributing to that in this way. I mean, it's got to make you feel really great.
Yeah, and, you know, I wish I could head down to Florida and help them out as well, too. You know, it looks like the Florida, they may be able to get response a little bit quicker. You know, unfortunately, in the Houston area, Harvey just kind of came over there and stopped.
Yeah.
And it took probably many more days than we wanted to before we could fly in and help them out, just for the area to clear out a little bit.
So what kind of advice, Nicholas, would you offer to other pilots that either might find themselves, you know, geographically close to a disaster of this type in terms of impact on humans, or just in general about volunteering? What are your thoughts? What are your tips maybe for other pilots?
Well, the first one, which I wasn't really aware of, I was going to be around so much traffic and kind of chaotic traffic. And thankfully, in my training, I train at a busy airport. You know, I fly 30 hours a month, and I've been in some pretty chaotic air traffic situations. But I can't explain how busy the Houston TRACON was going in and out of the Houston area for a few days. I sent a photo to you, Max, of my four flight with some of the aircraft showing up there and just how nuts it was. And, you know, how busy the controllers were. So if you're not comfortable in those types of environments, don't fly, because it could be a dangerous situation if that's something you're uncomfortable with. So, you know, make sure you're confident in those types of situations.
Hmm. Well, as we record this, it's September 11th, which of course is cause for, you know, a lot of emotions just because of the anniversary. But, you know, to be talking about this and helping pilots, helping others in time of need, it kind of reinforces it, at least in my mind. I mean, Rob, what do you think? The impact that all of us can have, that pilots can have, that others can have in times like this is, I mean, it's an important thing to participate in, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. In fact, I was thinking the same thing you were there about the irony of the fact that, you know, many people have forgotten about Harvey, which was just, you know, over a week ago, because it was sort of superseded by the intensity of Irma. And then today, of course, as we're hearing people coming out from under saying, hey, I'm here, I'm okay. In fact, I had family down in Sarasota that I spent most of the last 5 days trying to convince to leave their home. And then the juxtaposition of 9/11, 16 years since they took down the towers and struck the Pentagon and almost took out the Capitol building.
I think this is really a shining moment for general aviation. I think a lot of folks are not aware of general aviation, and this is a perfect opportunity to make people aware of it, and for pilots to give back, to use their skills, and to feel good that they're helping others who are less fortunate. In terms of, you were talking earlier about how these groups came together, I found it remarkable talking to the Operation Airdrop guy, just in terms of the number of different organizations that were putting supplies together at different depots. So he mentioned some religious organizations and businesses and things like that, just sending the supplies to the depots, and other folks on the receiving end. They said they had National Guardsmen helping to load supplies into the aircraft when they showed up. And it's remarkable how people just kind of figured out how to put together an operation over a short period of time by contacting people they knew and figuring out how to get it done. So I think it's a real credit to GA and the pilots.
Yeah, for sure. And while doing it for those reasons is really all that should be necessary, though, it's interesting that you talk about or mentioned how it reflects positively on GA. And, you know, not to, you know, beat chests or anything, but it probably is beneficial to all to, you know, kind of make that known. And I don't know if that means talking to the press about it in ways that illustrates how general aviation is, you know, good for the country or through other means, but just making people aware that these things are happening and it's made possible by the fact that we have a healthy general aviation culture here in the United States. That's an important part. So, I mean, I hope we, you know, kind of seize that opportunity as well.
And we should also mention that it's not just general aviation. You look at public service aircraft as well as military aircraft, and wow, you know, we have just a massive effort by aircraft of all type and all types of sectors contributing to this. As we were sitting here talking, I was glancing at Twitter, and there's a picture of some, I can't remember how many hundred people who are loaded on a C-17 ready to fly into Irma, so military personnel. So, yeah, this we have enormous capabilities in this country, and, you know, when we have a problem, I think it's remarkable how everybody kind of comes together to figure out how to help each other.
Yes, yeah, it's very cool. Nicholas, since we have you, and maybe we can take an opportunity to learn a little bit more about Redbird. And for those in our audience listening who are unfamiliar with the company, maybe you can give us kind of a little overview.
Sure thing. So Redbird Flight Simulations, we make, you know, commercial flight simulators for, you know, flight training schools. It's kind of where the company started. But, you know, over the past few years, really started expanding quite a bit. So we're starting to make models now that we're seeing in, you know, high schools and middle schools across the country in support of STEM education and just in people's homes that, you know, want to make sure they're staying current as far as, you know, flying day to day. Maybe, like we mentioned earlier, those pilots that fly 10 hours a year, well, if they're sitting at home, you know, maybe shooting a few approaches, even though it may not be loggable at home, they're at least their mind is working on aviation. So all the way from that home flight sim to the full motion simulators that you see, and we even make some custom ones for like King Airs and Caravans and things like that. So that's what we make. And in particular, I work on a product that was just released at Oshkosh called GIFT. It stands for Guided Independent Flight Training. And it's a simulator-based training supplement that teaches you, in our initial release for the private pilot course, the private pilot maneuvers. And so you can get in there, you can fly all the different maneuvers. It's interactive in the sense that there's actually, it's my voice. So if you go in there, you'll hear my voice.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
You know, telling you to, it is, you know, so if you're flying too slow on an approach, I'm going to tell you, you know, hey, you need to pitch your nose down to speed up kind of stuff. So the simulator understands what you're doing and tries to coach you through the maneuvers. And then at the end, of course, you get a score based on, you know, the ACS standards and some other performance numbers that we feel will be helpful for you and your flight instructor to review. So that's a product I've been working on that was just released at Oshkosh. And, you know, now we're working on setting up an instrument course for it and additional things. We're using the same technology we developed for that for a STEM course, you know, as we're seeing a high interest in aviation from high schools and middle school for that.
Oh, really? There is the pull from our educational institutions?
There is. And, you know, we've got some great people at Redbird working on answering those questions and providing, you know, great solutions for that interest. But, you know, at Oshkosh, if you get anybody happen to stop by the Redbird booth, we had an actual live STEM lab happening. We had Greg Rourke from the Aspen Aviation Alliance there teaching kids basically on a stage stuff from his STEM program in Aspen. But And we're actually developing solutions, curriculum, and special training modules based on the GIFT technology for these STEM programs now. So it's a big, big interest, and I think it's a great one.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Now, so I gather that your interest, your history pre-Redbird involved your interest with X-Plane, right? So, I mean, is that where it started for you and you discovered one day that you could get paid for doing what you love to do?
So, yeah, you know, I've been a Mac user forever. I come from the creative background. I do a lot of audio and video production and post-production work. So I've always been a Mac user. And, you know, 15, 16 years ago, I was like, I want a flight simulator, you know, at home. And my only choice was X-Plane. So that's what I've been flying forever. And, you know, a few years ago, you know, I just happened to find out that, wow, you can actually make a living, you know, in flight simulation. This is pretty cool. And, I happened to, you know, get a pretty much a dream job over there at Redbird, and I've been loving it ever since. And here I am now, actually a certificated pilot.
Right, you started with simulations and in the beginning, and then went to physical flying later on. Tell us about X-Plane Junkies. What is that all about?
Well, so X-Plane Junkies was a fun little project that I had started a few years ago. Really is just, I was pretty active and involved in the X-Plane flight simulation community. And I decided, you know, hey, I kind of want to take this another level. I created a website, kind of a social media presence. And I started streaming, you know, through, you know, Twitch, which is like a kind of like a live streaming for gamers.
Sure.
My flying. And then I started teaching people how to, you know, fly different maneuvers or to, you know, fly in a particular type of instrument approach. People really liked it. And then I created a little video training course to teach people basically private pilot type stuff and started selling it. And everything was kind of cool, you know, so it grew organically over about a year and a half. And, then I got picked up by Redbird. And unfortunately at that time, kind of my content creation of X-Plane Junkies kind of fell a lot lower than it had been. But I'm about to kind of do a nice resurgence with it. I've been working with a local cinematographer here in Austin, and we're planning to do an actual YouTube video series based on my real world flying. And we're going to kind of take the next level of aviation videos on YouTube. So, you know, I love, you know, all the YouTube video creators out there right now, like Steve-O Knievo, one of my favorites, you know, Josh Flowers, Mr. Aviation 101. He's here in the Austin area. He went up as a safety pilot for me one time. And, I love what those guys do. And I just want to do something a little bit different and, something unique that's not just strictly for aviators and wannabe aviators, but something that everybody can find interest in. So the pre-production started on that. I'd like to have it kind of starting to be released by the end of the year, but it may not be until early 2018.
Fascinating. Are there any broad trends in flight simulation these days? I mean, are there any sort of big picture things that are impacting what flight simulation means for people that love to use it?
Well, I think the biggest thing is people transitioning from home flight simulation to actual real flight training is really where things are changing. You know, we're seeing, you know, CFIs now that are getting kids that may have been flying home flight sims for 5-7 years on virtual air traffic networks. And on their very first flight, you know, their radio communications are 80% of where they need to be. You know, they at least understand the controls of the aircraft. So they're just getting a lot more experienced students coming into training. So I think that's the biggest change to the industry that home flight simulation is having.
Max T, were you ever a sim fan?
No. You know, I think I have the same challenge that, you know, Rob has. When we started flying, we were still using the Wright Brothers original models. There weren't too many sims around back then.
But I still like playing with them. I mean, I always have. I was an early, Microsoft Flight Simulator guy. And but it's funny, I never made the, after Microsoft dropped Flight Sim when maybe 10 years ago or 8 years ago, I somehow never made the transition back into it after that.
Yeah, you know, in the last 10 years, home flight simulation has changed quite a bit, who the players are, and really just the quality and level of the actual simulations themselves. And then the third-party services, like probably the biggest help for me before I became a pilot, and honestly a great service to even existing pilots who may struggle with radio communications, or services like Pilot Edge. You know, Redbird uses them in a EAA Pilot Proficiency Center. And it's, I mean, it is so close to the real thing when it comes to radio communications. And I know a lot of people struggle with that, but that was a huge benefit for me, having gone through that and being comfortable with that in my training. It was one less thing I had to worry about while I was training, because I was so comfortable already on the radios.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Well, Nicholas, we should give you an opportunity to tell us where we can learn more about Redbird Flight, where we can learn more about X-Plane Junkies, or even where we can find you personally online.
Absolutely. So we'll start with Redbird, redbirdflight.com. You can find all the information on our simulators, as well as our other services that Redbird offers as well, too. As far as X-Plane Junkies, xplanejunkies.com is the website, and then the social media is pretty much all at X-Plane Junkies. That's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and you can find me there. That's where I'm most active.
Great, great. And again, you know, thanks so much for your part in helping the victims of the hurricane in Texas. Really hope it can be sort of an inspiration for other pilots to find ways to get involved. There isn't always, I guess, such a dramatic event, but there are lots of ways that pilots can, you know, provide those kinds of support services that really can't get accomplished any other way. So we really, really appreciate that you've personally been, you know, doing something about that. And of course, we also appreciate you being one of our listeners.
Well, I love this show, and it was kind of nice getting a message from you, Max, inviting me on. But, you know, doing these flights here, it was more than just a reason to fly. It really became something that kind of changed me on a personal level as well, too. And, you know, something I haven't been able to do that I wanted to do, and I couldn't even imagine beforehand how it was going to impact me. And you know, now I can't wait to, you know, maybe fly that Veterans Airlift Command mission or something like that, you know, or Pilots in Pause mission, something to help somebody else out. It is a great, gratifying feeling. And you know what, if you're a young pilot, you know, pursuing a professional career or anything, you've got those hours to build, you know, make the most out of them, and, you know, go do something good and along the way.
Fantastic advice.
Hey, one last question, actually, Nicholas. Did we ask you what kind of an airplane you were using?
No, you didn't. And I was flying a 1978 Piper Archer PA-28-181, which is part of the flying club, the Shandell Flying Club here in Austin that I'm a member of. And I will say I got really, really good at doing the weight and balance calculations, you know, putting 450 plus pounds in that aircraft and getting the CG just right was definitely an exercise in weight distribution. But, you know, in six flights, I carried almost 1 ton of supplies. And that's a lot for a little plane like that.
Wow. You're not kidding. Nice job.
Yeah, very cool.
And I just want to second his comments about getting involved in nonprofit organizations and volunteering and helping, and also being a good way to build time. 20-plus years ago, I was probably a, 400-hour pilot, now about 20 times that. But I got involved with flying doctors, Los Médicos Voluntarios, and that became just a really fulfilling thing to fly volunteer doctors and dentists down to Mexico, and built up a bunch of hours in the process. So I agree. You learn so much from these trips, and you get a great feeling that you're helping give back as well.
Great. Very good. All right. Again, Nicholas, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, let's do a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Rob, anything going on aviation-wise with you?
Oh, yeah. I just came back Saturday afternoon from the Midwest Light Sport Aircraft Show down in beautiful Mount Vernon, Illinois. Hmm. And for people that don't know where that is, it's right near the place where the eclipse would have been total if I'd been able to get down there that day. It's down near Southern Illinois University, but had a good time, spent a couple days, met a lot of really nice people, flying a host of really cool light sport aircraft, and looked at a bunch of new designs and heard some interesting thoughts, I just had a ball, to tell you the truth.
So what's that show like? Are there the manufacturers represented, or is it more like a fly-in for the enthusiasts?
It's kind of both. Most of the major light sport manufacturers were there. Names, of course, that our listeners might not even be familiar with, at least some of them. Of course, the Rands people were down there. We've had him on the show before. We'll have to get James Wiebe from B-Light Aircraft and his Chipper aircraft on. There were just all kinds of cool, fun airplanes that I saw. And again, the folks were really nice. They had some great food and some, since that's almost near the Kentucky, Illinois state line, of course, all the music tended to be rather country sounding, you know.
Yeah.
Guys with big hats and cowboy boots and
bluegrass
guitars
and that kind of thing, probably.
Well, I don't think it was bluegrassy. No. I'm not a bluegrassy guy, but this was just plain old country strumming, you know. My girlfriend left me and took the dog and left me without my car, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like Max Truscott.
It sounds kind of like Texas music.
Yeah, it's the same everywhere.
Yeah, well, yeah, a little bit, I guess. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
I forgot we got a guy on there from Texas.
That's right.
So you know what those people sound like. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding, guys. I like people from Texas.
That's right.
Yeah, it's true.
Max, what have you been doing lately?
Well, I spent the Labor Day weekend up in New England, and I found my way up to Bangor, to the Maine Air Museum, which is at what used to be the old Dow Air Force Base. And that was the first time that I had been back there in most of my life. I was about 2 years old when I was last in Bangor. My dad worked at the Dow Air Force Base. He was a captain of the Air Force, a doctor. And I had only been to Maine once since then until this trip, and never all the way back to Bangor. So had great fun visiting the Maine Air Museum, learned a lot about the old Dow Air Force Base and what they were doing at that old SAC base, the B-52s, and had fun actually driving around and found what used to be the old base hospital where my dad would have worked. So it was kind of a fun connection to the past. My sister was born in that town, so had a lot of fun just driving around there. That was a side trip for me, where I was visiting family, and we were mostly down on the coast, down near Bethel, and we went up to Acadia and did some hiking. So anyway, it was a fun trip around Maine, where somebody told me that Maine was the northernmost southern state. So I don't even want to go there. I thought that was kind of funny, but it was beautiful. Some of the leaves were already starting to turn, and it was just a super, super time up there. And then, of course, the other thing is that just put up a new episode of Aviation News Talk, and we already talked about that, talking about Operation Airdrop. So just want to encourage folks that are looking to help out, go to their website and either donate money or look at signing up for some flights, because they expect to start flying on Wednesday down to do a relief effort for Irma.
In Florida, yeah, for sure.
And also the Caribbean. They think that there may actually be a greater need in the Caribbean.
Well, yeah, it does seem that some of those islands down in the Caribbean were pretty seriously devastated. That maybe is where the need is greatest.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I forgot I should have mentioned that, too. I mean, just having been down in St. Martin a month before last, I mean, you know, the St. Martin International Airport there, Princess Juliana, was just almost flattened, just almost completely destroyed by, you know, the winds that were up in the nearly 180 mile an hour category. And so there are still people down there that some of us that were at a conference a few months back haven't been able to find. Of course, they have no power. They have no internet. They have no phones. So we are still keeping our fingers crossed that those folks are okay. And but again, the islands down there did get hit pretty hard.
Yes. All right. Well, why don't we continue our recent trend of bringing you a positive airline story each week. We try to do this each week. And, you know, when we started doing this, Rob, I thought that it might be kind of hard to keep finding positive stories. But, you know, it hasn't been that difficult. And I understand that you've got one for us this episode.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't tell you what it is.
Thanks, Rob.
It's been a couple of, no, I'm kidding. No, actually, I just happened to hear this today on the radio. American flew a 757 full of goodies down into the Florida region. Of course, they serve Miami from O'Hare. United doesn't go into Miami out of O'Hare, but they did. You know, they're supporting the sort of the rebuild, I guess, with personnel and in the sense of employees going down. And you know, what's really interesting is that having been following this darn storm so closely with family down there, I think everybody was prepared that the west side of Florida was the place that was going to get just hammered, and it didn't turn out that way. The folks in Miami really took a beating. Miami International Airport is still closed, there have also been. I mean, I heard too that the folks up in Jacksonville really got hammered, and but all said and done, you know, since we have Nicholas on the show too, we can't forget about Houston. I mean, there are a lot of people that are still hurting down there.
Yeah, I have a lot of family in Houston, and it's amazing at how many of their neighbors are still in not great situations. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that it lasts a long time.
And there's some other stories, as long as we're mentioning it. I saw that the Chicago Tribune said that United CEO Oscar Munoz is going to be personally matching up to $1 million in donations given by the Airline Employees Relief Fund. And Delta sent a flight down on Monday, I guess, into Houston, loaded with relief supplies. One of the airlines had donated miles to the Red Cross. That was Alaska Airlines, donated $100,000 and 1 million miles to Red Cross to help fly relief workers at no charge to Texas airport. So I think it's nice. So the airlines are stepping up. You know, it's every sector is getting involved in doing what they can do to help.
Yeah, that's great. It really does feel like it's time for everybody to step up to the plate and do what they can. All right, we have a few listener mails that we wanted to talk about. First, we heard from Allison Martin. She's the VP of Scholarships for Whirly Girls. And if you're not familiar with Whirly Girls International, they're a nonprofit charitable organization, and they're focused on advancing women in the helicopter aviation industry. And Allison Martin wrote to us and let us know that the Whirly Girls 2018 scholarship opportunities are open now. There are 16 scholarships that they're going to award to deserving female aviators in 2018. And the scholarship sponsors, boy, you know, what a list. Listen to these companies: Airbus, Ericsson, Embry-Riddle, Flight Safety International, 4Flight, Garmin, Night Flight Concepts, Oregon Aero, Robinson Helicopter Company, Survival Systems USA, Western Helicopters, also a number of private individuals. So that's really great to see. You can learn more at whirlygirls.org. Scholarship applications are available there. They're due October 1st, 2017. So that's going to come up pretty quickly. And the scholarships will be awarded in February at their annual Whirly Girl Awards Banquet. That's going to be held in conjunction with Heli Expo in Las Vegas, Nevada. So again, that's whirlygirls.org. Another item, this is kind of interesting. We've been talking about ATC privatization quite a bit for kind of a long time now, several months now. And we received an email from Alan Clendenin, and this is on Flyers for Fairness. So I think it's been pretty obvious if you've been listening that most of the people you hear on Airplane Geeks are not big fans of privatization of air traffic control. I mean, Rob, would you say that's a fair statement?
Oh, I'd say probably.
So what we have here is an announcement of the launch of this organization's Flyers for Fairness. Now, this takes a different viewpoint. They say they're dedicated to modernizing the nation's ATC system and making air travel safer and more efficient. They really are pro-modernization for air traffic control. They say that they are going to expose the anti-modernization campaign. This is their words, mounted by corporate and private jet owners. And I love this one. And their special interest group, the National Business Aviation Association. Rob, I don't really think of the NBAA as being a special interest group for being opposed to air traffic control privatization, do you?
No, I'm afraid I don't. But, of course, this particular group is backed by the airlines. And, you know, what else are they going to say? And I think what's really sad, though, is they make it sound like those guys, the Flyers for Fairness, are in favor of ATC modernization and improved safety, and the rest of us aren't, which is just bull.
Not true. Yeah.
We all want to see the system modernized. We all want to see it be even safer than it is. But when people ask the hard questions like, okay, how are you going to bring about these reforms, it's kind of like listening to a friend of ours that occupies the White House that says things like, don't worry, you're going to love it. It's the best it's ever, you'll never see anything like this ever again, and you're going to be so happy once it's done. But the only thing they want us to do is just sign on the dotted line and give them all the assets and keep our fingers crossed. And that's what I think people are really upset about on the anti-privatization side, is they don't believe this stuff's going to happen.
Well, look at this statement. They're going to make air travel safer. The last crash of a U.S. airliner was in 2009. So how do you make air travel any safer than it is today? They don't give any example of how they're going to, suddenly go another 50 years without any crashes. It's
well, and there's some particularly incendiary, comments in that first sentence. The average airline passenger and coach is being taken for a ride by wealthy corporate and private jet owners. Really? Okay. I'm afraid I didn't realize that. And again, I know, Max T, you were mentioning Bob Poole's last newsletter, and we've had Bob on the show a number of times, and he had me right up to the end talking about the improvements in the system. He was relating the story in San Francisco, and the FAA did fall down on the job, by letting some of that stuff go on for a day before they even – notify the proper the proper chain of command to investigate it. And then he says, and if we just privatized the ATC system, it would all be better. Yep. Whoa, hang on. Wait a minute. How did you make that leap?
Exactly.
Just show me how you make that leap from the FAA was kind of, negligent or not very diligent, however you want to put it, and privatization will fix all that. Just tell me how. And that never gets answered.
Yeah, they're not going to answer that question. And the one thing that actually caught my eye on this is that they're not using the words privatization anymore. They're kind of going through that, they probably found out that word is bad. Now they're kind of this anti-modernization, or modernization is the right words to use. And,
right.
This is obviously kind of a piece that was very delicately written, not for us pilots and things like that, but for the rest of the voting public.
Yeah.
Well, and they're always pointing overseas to how great things are at the other countries that are privatized, which I think there are literally two, which would be the UK and Canada. And here's an article that says that basically in the UK, they're, as they say, in a total meltdown. They have more delays, widespread technical glitches. They said that this came out of the BBC. In late June, said that they may be in need of a bailout from the UK government. I mean, this whole idea that privatization is somehow automatically always better, it's fallacious. And I think, to his credit, Robert Poole has made a very great income over his career by pushing privatization and getting lots of great donations from the people that support his Reason Foundation and support those ideals. So, yeah, I would love to have people donate, $1 million or more, and I'd be happy to, talk about how great privatization is.
So, in a way, we bring this up not to, strictly to blast this organization or anything like that, but just sort of in the interest of balance. So, you make up your own decision about air traffic control privatization or modernization or whatever, you want to call it. That's a decision for you to make. So we offer this up. This is a different perspective. As you can tell, not one that we are very much attracted to. You can find this this website. It's at flyersforfairness.org. Take a look and form your own opinion. Don't let us influence you, right, Rob?
Oh, no. Certainly not. We would never try it.
Okay.
Hey, and actually, we should mention that it is possible the House will vote this week on their version of the FAA reauthorization bill, which would include privatization. So if there is anyone out there who's listening who has not yet contacted their representative in the House, now is the time to do it. Do it right now. Just go to govt.eaa.org. Type in your zip code and send off the letters to your House representative in particular. I mean, I find it's fascinating that we've got two major hurricanes. We have all kinds of things, and the House has prioritized voting on privatization above all that. But hey, just one man's opinion.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to bring this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast to a close. We really want to thank our guest, Nicholas Rizzo. Nicholas, it's been wonderful to have you on the show. You're doing so many great things, and I think having so much fun along the way. It's just a real pleasure to have you with us.
Well, once again, this was a great experience for me, and I appreciate the invitation. There's one thing I forgot to say. If you guys happen to reach out to me on one of my social media, or if you're on the Airplane Geeks Slack team, I'm pilot.rizzo, R-I-Z-Z-O. Reach out to me if you're in the Austin area. You want to see how our Redbird simulators are made, maybe some of the ones that the custom ones that we're making. Shoot me a message. I'd love to give you a little tour of our office here in Austin.
I bet that'd be a fascinating tour. What kinds of things would you get to see on a tour of Redbird?
Well, probably the two coolest areas are going to be where we do our final assembly in the back end of our offices, where take all the parts. And I mean, we actually manufacture the simulators here in Austin. So seeing how they get put together in the various stages. And then the other part that nobody wants to leave on those tours is what we call our build room. And that's we have a demo full motion simulator in there that we do testing on. But it's also where we build customer devices before and to test them out before they get shipped out. So we have, like right now, we have a Piper M600 with actual, you know, the Garmin avionics in it. We've got helicopter sims in there sometimes. And, you know, so we have all kinds of sims in various states, but it's always interesting for us nerds.
Cool. And of course, Redbird is at redbirdflight.com, right?
Yeah, redbirdflight.com, redbirdflightsimulations.com also still works as well.
Great. All right. Well, you
I actually have one question for you, Nicholas. Out in the back of the factory there in Austin, do they, you know, sort of throw out old simulators that if, you know, the right person were there at the right time, they could pick up a real deal?
Well, yeah, I'm sure if you would love to donate, you know, $80,000 or so, we'll get you your very own full motion simulator in your garage for you.
Well, hang on here. Now, Rob said he wanted an old simulator. Now, do you have any, like, Wright Flyer simulators?
You know, we don't. We've actually done some cool ones. Like, we did a P-51 Mustang that we had at Oshkosh. It's painted up like Old Crow, just like the famous P-51. And, you know, so we do these kind of special one-off ones and of some older aircraft. We did was it the P-46, I think, at one point in time as well, too.
Cool. Wow. Nicholas, tell us about the origin of the name of the company, Redbird.
Okay. Yeah. So this is, and if you visit our offices, you'll actually see the photo of this as too, right when you walk in. But when the founders, Jerry Gregoire and friends decided they wanted to make a flight simulation company, they thought it was going to be a great idea to make a simulator out of a old aircraft frame. So they found this Cessna 177 frame that was in a field somewhere, just kind of rotting. And they're like, man, we're going to turn this into a simulator. And they found out pretty quickly it's not a good idea to do that. And so, but when they're naming the company, they said, hey, we tried to make one out of a Cardinal, Redbird. That can kind of fit various ways for aviation. So that's how it got the name Redbird.
Hmm. And the company was founded when, about 2006, was it?
Yeah, it was 11 years ago, I believe. I think it was about 11 years ago.
Hmm. Very good.
Come a long way.
Oh, for sure. Well, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com, of course. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/469. On our website, you'll find links to where you can find us on social media, how to contact us, how to subscribe. And we also have a donate button if you'd like to help support the show financially. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. And Rob Mark, let's start with you.
Well, any place that has Jetwine in the name or usually hanging around Flying Magazine. I mean, and as I always say, I don't mean really inside the magazine, but, you know, helping to put it together and things.
Great. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, you can find me on the flight line at Palo Alto Airport here in the San Francisco Bay Area. 5 or sometimes 6 days a week, I'm out there flying. So anybody in the Bay Area who wants to go flying, check out the Cirrus or something like that, definitely contact me. And you can do that through the aviationnewstalk.com website. Just click on contact at the top there and look for us wherever you find podcasts.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me on LinkedIn. Also with David Vanderhoof each week on the UAVDigest.com and with Mary Kirby on PaxXPodcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
See ya.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.